Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. The quorum is present?
Yes.
The quorum is present. So first order of business is approval of the minutes. We actually have two sets of minutes to approve. The first is from the joint hearing that we had with the Commerce Committee on January 30th. Representative Bierman?
Yes, Madam Chair. I approve the minutes of January 30th, please.
All right. Motion to approve the minutes from the joint hearing with the Commerce Committee from January 30th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and those minutes are approved. And then we have the minutes from this committee from February 9th. Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, I make a motion to approve the minutes from February 9th.
All right, thank you. So those minutes are before us. Any discussion to the minutes of February 9th? Oh, should be 14th. Oh, sorry, February 14th. We've got to make sure that we're moving the right minutes here. Let me just make sure. Yes, February 14th. How could we forget Valentine's Day? So the motion is to approve the minutes of February 14th that are in your packet. So any discussion to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes of February 14th are also approved. Thank you very much. Okay. First on our agenda today, we're going to hear House File 693. Right, and Representative Fisher? Oh, okay. So, all right, we're going to hear. All right, so we're going to start prior to House File 693. We're going to have a little bit of an intro presentation. And, oh, good, Representative Fisher is here, too. So welcome to the committee, and please go ahead. And members, just... because this session we didn't do a whole bunch of introductory meetings and overviews and so on, we're trying to give folks a little bit of background as we take up bills that are related to these different areas. So that's why we're doing this. It's a little bit abbreviated, but that's our goal here. So welcome. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is PJ Weiner. I'm a manager within the Department of Human Services Healthcare Administration.
And Ms. Weiner, please, mics in this room are so not good, so please talk.
Is this a little better?
That is okay. Better. Thank
Fantastic.
You.
Thank you. So I'm going to do a quick overview of managed care for the committee this morning. I will be skipping through some of the slides in the interest of time today, but the full slide deck should be available to all of you in your packets this morning. So to begin, how Minnesota purchases health care for our medical assistance enrollees. Currently, around 15% of enrollees are in the fee-for-service program, which is where DHS processes claims and pays providers directly for services. And that means that 85% of medical assistance enrollees are in the managed care program, where DHS pays managed care organizations to provide benefits for enrollees. That's where MCOs, as we call them, managed care organizations, process claims and pay providers directly. The state contracts with managed care organizations to deliver provider networks that can vary from the fee-for-service provider network, payment arrangements, which again can vary from the fee-for-service contracted rates, and care coordination and disease management for complex cases. So I'm going to skip to who is covered through managed care. Our managed care programs are broken up into three different contracts. We have our Families and Children's Contract, which covers the PMAP Medical Assistance Program, parents, children, and adults without children who are eligible for medical assistance based on income. And Minnesota Care is also covered through this contract. We have our Seniors Program, which covers people who are 65 and over, most of whom who have Medicare as their primary coverage. And we have two products for our seniors, our MSHO product, which is for people who are dually eligible for Medicare and medical assistance and are enrolled in the same plan for both Medicare and medical assistance. And we also have our MSC Plus plan, which is just covers the medical assistance benefits. One thing we do want to note is that home and community-based services are actually covered through managed care for this population. So those are the elderly waiver services and PCA services as well. And that's a bit of a difference in terms of how those services are covered for other populations. The other program we have is our special needs basic care program, which is for people with disabilities ages 18 to 64. Half of this population also has Medicare as their primary coverage. And as I indicated in this contract, only the what we call basic care services are covered, which are the basic medical care services. Home and community-based services are covered through fee-for-service for this population. And we do want to note that people enrolled or eligible for SMBC can opt out if they choose to do so. In managed care, the plans also provide care coordination and disease management to their enrolled population. MCOs are required to provide initial screenings for all enrollees to assess urgent and ongoing health care needs. They provide care management for their populations to ensure care is delivered and coordinated between settings and payers. And they provide disease management for people with chronic or complex illnesses. And we should also mention that our seniors and SMBC programs both have enhanced care coordination activities due to the acuity of the population served in those programs. There are some flexibilities that exist within managed care solely, and we'll talk a little bit about those. Managed care plans are able to cover what we call in lieu of services. This is a federal benefit that's granted to managed care organizations, and it's a flexibility that allows plans to cover an alternative service if the enrollee wishes to do so in lieu of another service. And we wanted to call this out because one of the in lieu of services that we're able to cover and get federal funding for are limited stays within IMD facilities that usually are not able to be covered with federal dollars, and there are some state dollars granted for those
and
services.
IMD is what?
IMD, you know we love our acronyms. Institute, they're referred to as Institutes for Mental Disease. It's an outdated acronym, but it would be Behavioral Health Inpatient Facilities. And I believe, I would have to check with my colleagues, the definition is it has to have at least 16 beds, which is the definition of an IMD.
Okay, so if we could just pause for one second, because I think that bears just a little bit of explanation.
Sure.
Because so what's called an IMD, Institute for Mental Disease, so there's a federal designation that says that Medicaid, now I'm going to ask you to correct me if I misstate any of this, but medical assistance is the federal portion is not covered under federal law if it's a facility with more than 16 beds, of which I think at least half are people with mental illness. I might be wrong about that, but we usually think of it has to be in a facility with 16 beds or less. And so that's kind of something we always work under because of that's the federal rule, right? So when we talk about the IMD rule, that's what we're talking about.
That's correct. And under managed care in a regulation that was passed in 2016, CMS does allow for what they consider short stays to receive some federal funding if it's through managed care. So we are able to get some additional federal funding when people are placed in an IMD and are there for a short stay as defined by CMS.
And if I could just follow up with that for just a second. So how does that, since we pay capitated rates to managed care organizations, so they're paid for already for this person that they're covering, where does that federal funding come in? Does that come back to the state?
So we actually track the stays in the IMDs, and if they exceed the length of stay, then we have to shift the funding source of those capitations. So they would be state funded if while someone is in an IMD.
Okay. Representative Bierman on that point?
Yes, Madam Chair. Just wondered what the length of stay permitted is.
15 days or less.
All right. Okay. Anyway, please continue.
Sure. Managed care plans also can provide additional benefits. These are benefits that are not paid for under the capitation, such as they provide car seats, gym memberships, food programs, and incentives for receiving well visits and screenings. And there were also flexibilities that we saw during the COVID response. MCOs can make program adjustments quickly in urgent situations, such as in the COVID response, where we saw mobile vaccine programs get up and running very quickly, transportation for non-medical services that were needed, and they were able to stand up virtual visits quickly and allow providers to bill under that modality as well. One other piece that we really wanted to touch on is the MSHO program and the integration that is offered through that specific program. And again, MSHO is Minnesota's fully integrated special needs plan for seniors eligible for both Medicare and medical assistance. And this is where they enroll into the same health plan for both Medicare and Medicaid, and they see a lot of efficiencies in doing so. It does require that there's an approved model of care under which the special needs plan meets the needs of each enrollee. MSHO program integrates Medicare, Medicaid, pharmacy, acute care services, PCA, elderly waiver, all under one health plan, which is helpful for the enrollees in that program. And there was also a longitudinal study of the program that did demonstrate that MSHO enrollees fare significantly better than peers without the same level of coordination of benefits. And we did want to mention that seniors that do not enroll in MSHO can choose to enroll in the MSC Plus program, which is that just covers the Medicaid services, not the Medicare services as well. We're going to skip a little bit through the procurement and contracting. We will mention that our state contracts are grant contracts and therefore are required to be reprocured every 5 years at least. And we have just finished a 2.5-year collaboration with counties to design and implement a competitive procurement process. And the procurements that we just concluded focused on goals established by DHS and the counties to eliminate racial and geographic disparities, address social determinants of health, improve outcomes for all enrollees, establish greater county collaboration, improve provider relations, and incentivize innovations in payment reform. There are enrollee protections that exist in managed care, either under federal regulation or even sometimes through our HMO laws here in Minnesota as well. So we just wanted to point that out as another item of managed care that exists that doesn't always exist for the fee-for-service population. And MCOs are involved in several initiatives to report quality of care, improve services, incentivize providers to improve care, and report on enrollee satisfaction. All of this information is available on our website, so I won't go through all of the information here, but we do have initiatives such as performance withholds, which are contractually required targets aimed at improving enrollee outcomes. We also do performance improvement projects where we work on a particular issue with all of the health plans over a 3-year period to try and work on a specific outcome measure. And then we've provided a bit of information on MCO oversight as well, including the financial oversight of our managed care organizations, our ombudsman program, which is where our DHS Office of the Ombudsman for State Managed Care Health Programs help enrollees navigate and advocate for fair equal treatment by MCOs. It's additional support that they get, and also to navigate through the healthcare system. And we also have contract oversight of our MCOs. They have several reports due to the state, and then we also oversee their compliance with the contract on all of the different measures that are included within the contract as well. And so we were asked to keep this to 10 minutes. I went a little over, so I did breeze through a few things there, but we're happy to answer any questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. Probably my fault that you went over, so no worries there. But thank you. If you could stay around, because I think we may have questions later, but I think I would like to get to Representative Fisher's bill. So Representative Fisher. So Representative Fisher is going to move House File 693 to bring it before the committee, and the intention is to lay the bill over today. And Representative Fisher, you have a pretty substantial amendment. So Representative Fisher, right, you want to move the DE1, I assume.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the DE1 to get the bill into the shape that I would like.
All right, so Representative Fisher is moving the DE1, and I think that probably the best way to proceed here, since all of the discussion is going to be on the DE1, is just to adopt it and have the bill in the shape the author would like, and then we will discuss the bill as amended. So all in favor of adoption of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Fisher, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, committee, for the opportunity to present House File 693 as amended. And what this is a bill to address our Medicaid system, to create value-based care that works in our system. Right now, that is something that does not always feel like it exists. What it would do is it does a variety of things. It would end managed care contracts with insurance companies by 2025, but it preserves the parts of the system that seem to be working very well. Examples would be preserving the county-based plans and the ones that are the facilities that are county operated. The county plans have done a great job over time, taking the payments that they have, increasing services, and in some instances, which is I was surprised pleasantly when I heard this, is that in many instances, county-based plans also pay more than Medicaid does on a number of the services because of the efficiencies they found in the system while wrapping in additional supports throughout their community to make sure they've got great outcomes. Some of the things that would happen is the state would directly reimburse providers as they currently do for the 14% of the Medicaid population that they're covering. It allows for supplemental payments for care coordination, prioritizes outreach grants for the very vulnerable and mobile populations, something that some of the counties are doing where they're wrapping in their social workers with their populations to help make sure they're getting the care. Let's make sure we're providing opportunities for that across the board. And it also requires some basic things out there. It's making sure that there's a hotline set up to assist folks who are trying to connect with providers and providing those kind of things, whether it's a hotline, making sure that we've got nursing services that are available, et cetera, and having these available on a 24/7 basis. The reason that that's a little bit about the bill. The reason that I'm bringing this up is because despite the name of it being managed care, in most cases, companies are essentially managing claims. They're not managing care. They cover 84% of a population, and in fiscal year 2019, there was over $8 billion paid out in Medicaid, and if you figure about 84% of that went into Medicaid, that's about $7 billion in that fiscal year that was going to basically insurance companies. Last week, we heard a bill from Representative Hicks that had testimonies from individuals with concerns about the managed care system, being able to opt in and out of it. One of the things that we heard is that insurance companies are paid money at the beginning of the year for services, but they don't always pay out all for legitimate services provided. During testimonies, we heard from Mr. Omar Jamel, who talked about the powerful versus the weak. And he was talking about that from the side of how individuals really don't have any power in the system. One of the things I'm going to show is that the same thing also exists with providers out there. People who are providing the services are also in the same situations. This power imbalance is something that really impacts small clinics that are rural or serving communities of color. It's because of their size, they are at the mercy of the insurance companies, where the insurance companies establish what the rates are going to be for reimbursement. They really have no say in what they're able to negotiate for rates. They're basically told, this is the way it is, take it. We often hear about how poor the reimbursement rates are for medical assistance. Well, I'll tell you, from what I've heard from providers out there, in many cases, the rates that they have under medical assistance, if they're getting direct payments from the state, are often better than what they're getting from the managed care programs. And in some instances, there are rates that we have established in statute of what we should be paying, and the managed care organizations don't pay that, and sometimes they pay significantly less than that. Insurance companies are primarily set up to process claims, a process that at times is better at rejecting claims for legitimate services provided than paying them. Many times the process a clinic or a provider go through when appealing these denials results in it costing so much that the work and resources they have to use to get reimbursed for claims is more than what the claims are going to be paid. And as a result, there's legitimate services that are being provided but are not getting reimbursed because of the denials that come from insurance companies. One of the ways that this happens is a convoluted way called credentialing. Credentialing is a process where providers must be vetted to make sure they are worthy to receive payment, primarily to make sure that they have not engaged in questionable activity in the past. And when they're going through credentialing, that means that during the time they're going through credentialing, they'll be providing services, but they will not be paid for the services that they provided by the insurance company, unless another provider who is credentialed is involved with providing those services. And this can be a handicap for a very small clinic sometimes when you've got a new provider coming in. The average amount of time that a provider spends on getting credentialed is over 60 hours for each individual. And the time is spread over days, weeks, and months. Payment for services then begins the day credentialing is finished with an insurance company. As I mentioned before, it does not pay for any services that were provided before that date. Credentialing for MA is done by the state, but insurance companies don't accept that and require payments for managed care in their system. So while somebody can go through credentialing and be credentialed with the state, when a managed care insurance company starts, is in the process, they will not use that same system. You have to use their system that is out there. Furthermore, it gets even more complicated. Is if a person is credentialed with company A, but is paid by company B, they're credentialed with company A. But if company B then enters the market, you have to get credentialed all over again with company B, even though company B was already paying the claims for company A. So I'm just showing the complexities that these small clinics have to go through. Some of the larger systems have got the robust enough for us to help work on these things, but for smaller clinics, this is one of the things that makes it harder for them to get reimbursed for their payments. While we do have state law addressing credentialing, I have heard repeated stories over the past year of organizations that have tried to get credentialing to occur, and they've had emails that are sent and are lost for months and then mysteriously reappear. They've had voicemails that they've left that they've never gotten returned. And this can go on for days and weeks or sometimes months. And all the while, remember, while this is occurring, the insurance company isn't having to pay for these services that are provided. And what incentive is it for the insurance companies to improve this process when that money all falls to their bottom line? I've seen state agencies involved trying to address this system, and I will say that we have some very large insurance companies out there with some very large clout that really fight back and are uncooperative with our state agencies. And they're not only uncooperative with our state agencies, some of these same companies are so large on the federal basis, they do not follow federal law even, and federal government has been going after some of these companies because of what they are calling fraud within the system for not following the process properly. So what chance does a small clinic have against some of these insurance companies? The next issue comes into claim denials, something that I also hear a lot about. In the Medicaid system, I've had people come to me saying, hey, the state is not paying my claims. And by the time I ask the questions, what it comes down to is they were under a managed care organization, and the managed care organization wasn't paying the claims. And so they would have to go back and find out who in the state do I contact to try to get a claim filed and work through that. And that's a process that can take weeks. And I've heard of organizations where they've had $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 of claims that they're waiting to be paid on because of this process through here. Sometimes these reasons for denials are legitimate. There may be something that they missing in the records that they should have submitted. Sometimes it's a question mark. And I've heard so often from providers, nurses and physicians, where they've complained to me over years is that they have to keep on refiling the same papers for the same claims, and they finally get processed through without changing anything. And so what I'm trying to show is how complex the system is using the managed care organizations. I will say from my experience, I found it's much easier to work with the state directly on their claims than it is to work with an insurance company. And I've heard similar from other organizations. Basically, what ends up happening, and I'm going to cut it a little shorter there because there's a lot more I could go into here, is that what it comes down to is eventually it puts the situation where these small clinics who are providing services to the most vulnerable in our society, whether they're rural clinics or in populations of color, end up being in a situation where they are forced into a situation, do they close or are they forced to sell to a bigger chain because they are no longer viable. So while the insurance companies will be up here saying all the great things that they do, the question I will bring to you, is it really a great service that is happening if in the end result is we have the small clinics who can really do great service in the individual clinics, in the individual communities, if they end up closing because they're not being paid for legitimate services that they're entitled to? And I will pause there and allow the testifiers to come up.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Fisher. And this is a big, big issue. And you've managed to compress a lot of it in a small time, and appreciate that. I mean, members just need to understand, you know, as these issues come before us, you know, it's hard sometimes to understand the difference of scale of some of these things we're talking about. This is an enormous issue for the state, as you mentioned. It's a lot of money that goes through this system, and a lot of people, what is it now? It's something like 1.5 or 1.4 million Minnesotans are on these public programs. So we're talking about essentially how we deliver care to all of these Minnesotans who are on our public programs and how the costs are being allocated. So thank you so much. Okay, first on the for testimony here, we have Rochelle Westland. Yeah. Welcome, and I'm going to ask the testifiers to keep your testimony very brief. We're kind of running a little bit behind here. If you can do it in about 2 minutes, that would be great. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Am I close enough?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Rochelle Westland. I'm the Director of Public Policy at the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. Thank you for the opportunity today to testify on House File 693 as amended. Because of time, I will be briefly focusing my comments on Sections 3 and 4. MNAC represents the state's 17 federally qualified health centers, or the FQHCs, and their patients. Collectively, the state's FQHCs serve nearly 200,000 individuals in rural and urban communities, and nearly 50% of our patients are enrolled in Medicaid or Minnesota Care. FQHCs provide a primary medical, behavioral health, and oral health services regardless of ability to pay. And for over five decades, FQHCs have tailored our services to address the social drivers of our patients' health outcomes. We deploy socioeconomic screening tools and find that our patients, on average, have at least seven social drivers of health, ranging from housing instability, food issues, domestic violence, or transportation. This bill focuses on helping to fund some of the work that we do every day. Specifically, the supplemental payments outlined in Subdivision 3 allows funding for the work FQHCs do to address these socioeconomic issues and the associated costs. Then Subdivision 4 recognizes a core component of the FQHC care model, specifically what we refer to as enabling services, and these services allow patients to access upstream primary care. In 2021, the 17 FQHCs spent roughly $24 million, or about 12% of our collective costs, in care coordination, community health workers, and patient outreach and education activities. These services support patients to access preventative care, access follow-up care and services, and help them self-manage chronic disease. These services improve primary care utilization and health outcomes and create a more accessible healthcare system for underserved communities. Finally, I just want to briefly mention in lines 2.3 and 2.5, it recognizes the valuable role of eligibility assistance for our patients. We make every effort to ensure our patients enrolled in these programs for which they're eligible, both in the public and private healthcare sectors. This will be particularly important with the unwinding of the public health emergency, and we are deeply involved in that effort as well. So we appreciate that House File 693 includes those proposals that advance FQHC's ability to improve health outcomes for communities. And I want to thank Representative Fisher specifically for highlighting the importance of the state's FQHCs in addressing the health and wellness of our communities. And thank you, Representative Liebling and committee, for your time.
All right. Thank you so much. Next, we have Kathleen Albrecht. Welcome to the committee. And on deck, we have Bonnie Bolash. So.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Kathy Albrecht. I am the Director of Medicaid and Special Needs Plan Product and Strategy at Medica, a regional nonprofit health plan based in Minnetonka. I welcome the opportunity to share my perspective on House File 693, which excludes Minnesota's nonprofit health plans from serving Medicaid and Minnesota care. Today, I'm going to talk specifically about the impact to our low-income seniors and people with disabilities that we serve. I've dedicated my entire career to improving the lives of our most vulnerable populations. I understand how confusing the system can be for them. A private managed care organization improves the health and well-being of our most vulnerable Medicare populations by integrating the Medicare and Medicaid benefits, coordinating patient care, and focusing on the individual needs of each vulnerable person in the program. Studies of our integrated care approach to vulnerable population are numerous. CMS recently contracted with RTI International to evaluate the state's MSHO program, and the study found that MSHO is widely considered a model of Medicare and Medicaid integration with a high degree of integration and high enrollment. The study compared it with a non-integrated approach and found that MSHO enrollees had less hospitalization and emergency department use and greater use of ambulatory care and home and community-based services. Inserted with my testimony is a page from this study showing examples of how managed care organizations have worked within the MSHO program. I encourage you to read this sheet to understand the positive impact of Medica's private health plans are having on low-income seniors and what will go away for nearly all low-income seniors if this bill passes. Do managed care organizations have room for improvement? Absolutely. However, in Minnesota, we've always prided ourselves on taking an innovative, collaborative approach. When we attend national meetings, the Minnesota model is held up as a national leader. Our state should not be moving backwards while other states are striving to achieve what we have already accomplished together in Minnesota. I'm testifying in opposition to House File 693, not due to the impact it would have on my company, but on behalf of the vulnerable people my team and I serve every day. Passage of this bill will create confusion, poorer health outcomes, and greater strife for them. Please do not enact this bill into law. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the for the opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Bonnie Bolash. Welcome to the committee.
Okay, I'm usually not used to doing this. Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Bonnie Bolash. I am here today because I have concerns about transferring the administration of Medicaid and MinCare to a third-party administrator. I want to see an inclusive healthcare system with acupuncture and Chinese medicine included. This summer, I researched and learned what I believe structural racism looks like and feels like in regard to how acupuncture and Chinese medicine has been treated in the U.S. Currently, Medicaid and MinCare covers acupuncture, but the current managed care organizations, the MCOs, seem to have different rules for their programs. It seems that our profession has no voice, and my concerns are that changing this will further lead to future problems regarding the administration of acupuncture coverage. I'm also concerned about structural racism. Currently, Minnesota laws do not define structural racism and therefore is permissible under law. My concern with this is that this change could lead to reduced care for populations that have been at risk for being excluded in receiving care and that there's no check and balance of the power. I know I would feel better if we defined structural racism in the Department of Commerce, health professional boards, Department of Human Services, and the insurance, with financial penalties assessed for violations. This is about systems at play for a long time that treat people and cultures as inferior, and it has to stop somewhere. Currently, acupuncture and Chinese medicine is being rebranded in Minnesota, the United States, and across the world. There are always systems at play, and we need to stop the structures that cause harm to people and cultures that do not have the power. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Phil Griffin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Madam Chair, members, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm speaking this morning on behalf of my client, the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans, IMCARE, Prime West, and South Country Health Alliance, an association representing the state's three county-owned and operated county-based purchasing plans, who for more than 40 years have been assuring access to quality, cost-effective care for the people enrolled in Minnesota health care programs. CBP plans currently serve more than 107,000 managed care program enrollees in 33 counties. Minnesota law passed in a bipartisan way in 1997 gives counties special authority to choose and adopt county-based purchasing. County-based plans are locally controlled, transparent, accountable directly to taxpayers, and partnering with providers to strengthen our rural health care delivery system. CBPs have county social services directly integrated into our delivery systems. Public program enrollees have one-stop shopping to get their transportation, child care, job training, housing, and health care services. We appreciate the recognition this amended bill gives to the work that we are doing and look forward to working with Representative Fisher on the bill. Madam Chair, members of the committee, if there are questions, we'd be happy to address them. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Thank you for being very brief, too. Dan Andreessen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, trade association for Minnesota's nonprofit insurers who serve as MCOs in the managed care program. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in our opposition to House File 693. The most important question I think before us today is, how will the lives of the 1 million Minnesotans currently on managed care be improved with this bill? The managed care model provides many significant benefits to the state, and it was mentioned care coordination, the wraparound services that insurers provide. And it was mentioned that CBPs provide those. MCOs provide those exact same services. And within your packets is a fact sheet on those services that we provide. Care coordination is serving the whole person, and it's not just about paying claims. It's helping them schedule their doctor's visits, helping arrange transportation, setting up mobile clinics, or arranging service through community-based services. Building health equity and addressing social determinants of health is a theme that's woven through all those aspects of care. And in fact, managed care and MCO procurement is a lever to ensure that accountability and progress towards those requirements are being met. MCOs must provide care that's required in the contracts. Many national reports have found that managed care has outperformed fee-for-service models because of this structured care coordination. The other advantage to the managed care model is financial predictability and accountability. Health plans take on the financial risk of insuring Minnesotans so the states can set a reliable health care budget. There is a significant amount of accountability in this process. The managed care program is a contractual partnership between MCOs and the state with many regulatory components that are outlined in 256B.69 and other sections of 256B. MCOs meet regularly with DHS to ensure requirements established in the contracts are being met. DHS contracts with MCOs annually who accept a predetermined per member per month payment, which is regulated by the state and DHS. These capitated payments have requirements on how much must be spent on health care, and if an MCO does not meet those requirements, they have to return the payments to the state, and this has happened in the past. State statute also caps MCO administrative expenses at 6.6% to ensure that state funds are being used for health care. MCO contracts include performance targets and quality improvement goals, and DHS ensures MCOs meet those standards through the use of payment withholds. MCOs are regularly audited for financial accountability and frequently send claims data to DHS, including an annual report on annual provider reimbursement rates. Again, in closing, how will the lives of the 1 million Minnesotans currently on managed care be improved with the elimination of managed care? The state went to managed care model for a good reason, and going backwards is the wrong direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. And lastly, we have Joel Euland. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Euland. I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs for UCARE. UCARE is a nonprofit health plan serving more than 650,000 members here in Minnesota. Of that number, 493,000 members would be impacted by this bill as they are enrolled in the Minnesota Care Program and the various Medicaid programs for families and children, people with disabilities, and seniors who are ages over 65. I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 693. This bill takes away the benefits of a managed care delivery system and essentially turns over the responsibility for paying claims to the Department of Human Services and to counties. Now, we are still working to understand the impacts of the delete all amendment that was just offered, but it is hard to believe that CMS would approve a plan that would limit the choices for members. UCARE still has staff who were around 40 years ago when the state moved to managed care. They saw the state struggle because many providers would not contract to serve Medicaid members. At one point in Anoka County, there was only one family physician in the county who would accept Medicaid patients, and no obstetricians that were available in Ramsey County. I worked for 13 years for a statewide disability organization prior to coming to UCARE. I saw young people with disabilities in institutional settings because there were few options available for them to move into the community. In the early 2000s, UCARE stepped up, partnered with the state, and created a program for people with disabilities to help them become more independent and to help improve the health outcomes for those members. This program established the building blocks for a special needs basic care program, currently serving people with disabilities in managed care. The program would end as a result of this bill. I took the job at UCARE because we are a health plan that's willing to dig in and not run away from a challenge. UCARE understands that being part of a health plan is not just paying claims. It is also achieving health outcomes for our members and improving their lives. The governor's human services budget identifies a success story. It proposes changing the parameters of the managed care performance withhold set by the legislature almost a decade ago to reduce hospital utilization and readmissions for Medicaid enrollees. Why is this change occurring? It is because the health plans achieved the performance targets set by the legislature. This is achievement that was accomplished because of the collaboration and partnerships between health plans, provider systems, and the Department of Human Services. Let's build on that type of collaboration model as we look to achieve positive outcomes for members enrolled in the Medicaid and Minnesota Care programs. I respectfully oppose this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify? Okay, not seeing anyone. So is there discussion to the bill? Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Fisher. First, the perennial question, is there a fiscal note for this, or when do we expect to see?
The fiscal note has,
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schumacher, the fiscal note has been requested. We've not received it yet.
Okay. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Fisher, in your introductory remarks, one point you made is that clinics have trouble getting reimbursement, and when they get some type of reimbursement from the managed care organizations, they can attempt to appeal it, but they're told that they're going to get what they've been paid and that they should just take it. Who at the state level do the clinics appeal to if they don't like that, or do they even need to with this if this is such a big issue?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schumacher. So often, most of the clinics just accept what's given to them. The process to go through to find out who you need to contact at the state is while it's set up in statute, most of the smalls, because of the size of their operation, don't always know who to be contacting. And in cases where they've reached out, the process after they've contacted with the state has taken weeks or months to be able to get things resolved, particularly with some of the larger insurance companies. These insurance companies have the ability, from what I have seen, is some of the insurance companies seem to stall the state just as much as they do the individual clinics. And it doesn't feel like the state really has the tools to be able to force the large insurance companies, some of them, to be able to cooperate. And I'm not saying every insurance company, but I'm saying some of them out there have a very bad record.
So we have Representative Backer, Nadeau, and Quam. Representative Schumacher, did you have anything else?
That'll do it for now, Madam
All
Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Backer.
Madam Chair and Representative Fisher, my question to you, Representative Fisher, Chair Fisher, is will this bill result for future choices for MA enrollers? I know with Representative Hicks, his opt-in bill was really talking about giving more choices. This, to me, gives less choices, especially obviously in greater Minnesota. So that would be my first question there, Chair Fisher.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Representative Backer. In some ways, it provides the same choices as it does now. As you heard through some of the testimony here, that we've got county-based plans that we're preserving. And in those areas, the county-based plans are still going to be able to operate and provide the services, and they are basically the only ones. Or you've got the option where they may go to medical assistance. What we're trying to do is reform the system here, taking a look at what has worked over time and providing good outcomes to what we have right now. And I think we've seen some evolution occurring. And I think the important thing is to take a look at is if we have choices out there, but it jeopardizes and causes a part of the system to collapse that is still independent and is also still providing services to the most vulnerable populations, not only in the metro area, but also throughout the state, is that really a good system? Then if it causes those independents to go away, we see what's happening in the healthcare system as we have these large organizations coming in, taking over parts of our medical system. You take a look at the mergers that have occurred out there with promises we're not going to close things, and they do. And what ends up happening is these small clinics may not be able to continue to survive because of the payment reimbursements, et cetera, something we want to address in this bill. And what happens is when these independents close, they become part of a larger system. And as they become part of a larger system, you get consolidation, they start closing in different parts of the state. And these are the concerns I have, is that the clinics out there, whether they're rural or the concentrations of poverty, end up closing, and those communities then have less services than they have now. So that's what I take a look at as a consequence. You may have choice, but if there's no one that you can get to in a reasonable amount of time, do you really have choice?
Representative Backer, one more, and then we'll go to Nadeau.
Thank you, Chair, Madam Chair. And I appreciate that, Chair Fisher. The challenge is you said that they'll have potential choices, but as a EMS provider, government is not easier to work with, okay? I have seen that. I will recognize that HMOs and even other insurance companies can be difficult, but there are a lot of examples that they have been easier to work with. I find that if I have a constituent that has a challenge, there are times that I can get through a private identity quicker than your government agency. So though I love county-based programs, believe me, Prime West does a wonderful job, but it's not through the whole state. We only have three county-based programs. So my concern is that we are taking the HMOs, eliminating that, and we have one big brother and sister that becomes less responsive, Chair Fisher. That is my concern. I agree with you that we should provide better health care, 100%. I just don't see the track record. I can name concerns with the agency that I have heard from constituents that they will provide better care. So that's my concern with that. And we can have a private conversation offline on that. But that's my concern. And thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Backer. I'm sorry. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of conversations. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks for your passion on this issue, Representative Fisher. Minnesota, you know, is kind of the envy of the nation, you know, as far as having local Minnesota-based companies that are willing to step up and provide care, and they've done it for years. You get outside of, you know, these areas, I mean, it's dominated by, you know, massively large, that you were alluding to, big national companies, you know, and the Blues, basically. Mm-hmm. We have lots of options here. And, you know, more people at the table, you know, is always better than less. And I appreciate the DE amendment that recognizes the value that county-based purchasing provides, that recognizes the value that Hennepin Health has done, the work that's been done to drive outcomes in really disparate populations and increased access. And now it's time to work on affordability. And I see that you're trying to simplify the system, reduce some of the, you know, maybe what you consider to be, you know, dollars that are wasted outside of the healthcare system. And I, you know, I appreciate that, but I find it difficult to look at this and say that, you know, the plans that have always been there to collaborate, begrudgingly sometimes, but they've always been there, they've always pulled their sleeves up, they've always focused on what the legislature, what the governor, what the people of Minnesota wanted to provide, you know, to provide those options. And I couldn't be more opposed to moving down the avenue where our public program participants have one option. That is not good anywhere. I don't care if it's Hennepin County, if it's in greater Minnesota, having one option to choose from will never drive. It might lower costs, maybe. I mean, we'll see in the fiscal note. I'm glad that this is being laid over, but if there's a problem with denials, for example, as you alluded to, I mean, we can solve that. Let's put a system together that actually addresses that in a real way. I was talking to somebody the other day. 1% of denials get appealed. 75% of those appeals get overturned. So maybe we need to figure out a better system for that. You mentioned that, you know, that fee-for-service is going to provide better rates than MCOs. I haven't seen that. I'd love to see the evidence of that. So we can look at that, and if that's accurate, you know, that's another option that we can look at. And credentialing, I mean, if under fee-for-service versus MCO operations, if we can provide a more efficient, effective way to credential, that is our job. That's easily solved. And then my final thing, and I really hope that I can continue to talk with you about this, because I do want to make sure that we improve outcomes for Minnesota families, is that I there's no language in the bill seeking the federal waiver. I think we're going to need that. I don't know if it was alluded to, you know, in the testimony anywhere, but I can't imagine that CMS is going to. Maybe they would. I don't know. But if nothing else, I think that should be added to the bill as well. Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, thank you, Representative Fisher. I know that you really care about this issue, and I hope I can keep working with you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Klum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author, I'm a little bit confused. I thought reform was changing or tweaking, not deleting the plan that almost 90% currently are under, and also not every county has the county-based. I'm glad that at least you're allowing county-based after you delete everything, but that means that in the majority of counties in the state, there wouldn't be no choice. There would just be one option. Of course, we got used to less choice when PPACA passed. I'm just surprised that we aren't looking at actually increasing choice, because it's the differences across the state and the differences between individuals that can be better addressed by more choice than a more restrictive plan. You sort of indicated not to believe the testifiers with what they're saying, but DHS testified before you said that, and you still stated that issues with appeals, and I noticed in their presentation there's two levels of appeals with the MCOs, and that I would think a if the appeals aren't good enough, maybe improve it. But you know, frankly, again, instead of whacking off the option that almost 90% have, but getting down to an issue that isn't being addressed is that there will be, what, 1.5 million requalification reauthorizations of MA, and the extreme amount of activity required from the agencies with that, kicking in this change, overlapping with that, what amount of additional staffing will be required to be able to do both of those activities at this during the same period?
So, Representative Crum, we don't have a fiscal note yet. I think you're asking a question that would be answered in the fiscal note. So,
Madam Chair, if you're doing a huge bill like this, you really ought to be talking to the departments. And one of the main questions you ask the department is, in order to implement this, how many FTEs during the transition, and have that discussion. Is there anything else going on during this time period we should be concerned about? I would think that would be something the author would have done.
I'll let Representative Fisher respond, but just to say that's what fiscal notes are for. But Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, Representative Schumacher. I have been in contact with the department. Whoops.
Yeah.
Where is that? Quam. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm looking at Schumacher. I apologize. Representative Quam. In terms of the department, I've been in contact with the department. I was initially just trying to get information as to what gross is being paid out each year in the insurance claims. I asked them that information over a week ago, and I would think just getting gross claim amounts would be enough, not needing to know by provider or anything else. I'm still waiting for that information. So just getting the simple information to be able to help guide is not readily available because it takes some time to get this information pulled together. So if I were to sit here and wait for the department, it might be next year before I have some of these answers, and I think the discussion that we're having here, the things we're talking about, is something that we cannot sit around and wait for. And where this comes into is that our system has changed greatly over the last couple of decades in terms of how the insurance companies are operating. And as you have consolidations and the power is transferring from the smalls, even from the states, to these larger corporations. And as an example, I'm going to highlight United Healthcare. This is an article that came out from NPR on the 2nd of this month, where United Healthcare efforts is they have hired doctors out there to deny claims coming in after a doctor has provided the service and says the person needs the service, and United Healthcare has said, no, we're not going to provide it because our doctor says you shouldn't have provided those services. So the services were provided, the patient was being taken care of, and the insurance company has refused to pay it. And this is what's going on, and this is one of the actors that is in our NCO system right now. So I have very low confidence that when the services are being provided, they're actually going to get paid for. And this is part of the reason I'm bringing it up and why we're having this discussion, because there are some good things out there, and I'm highlighting the county plans out there. You're right, we don't have them across the state, but how would the system look differently if we had those kind of plans throughout the state? We might be in a different situation because the counties are reaching out to populations right now that the NCOs aren't. You take a look at the social workers they have that are working with the homeless populations, the mobile populations, those who've got SUDs. They're connecting them with the services on a holistic basis. And I think this is where we need to be going to be able to provide that service. And that's something that the insurance companies just aren't going to be able to do. I'm taking a look at a vision of where we can take the system, seeing the good things that are starting to happen and evolve it.
Okay,
and I'm sorry,
we're going to have to get to the end of the discussion here because we do have other bills, but Representative Ryer is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm hoping I can have two questions.
Please,
thank you.
Go ahead.
First of all, I just want to make a comment that we've been, people have talked about limits on choice, and to me, direct payment opens up choice. It allows people to have more control over who they want to see and where they wish to receive care. So going to my first question is about the county-based purchasing. I've seen that really advance over the years, I'm going to say since 1997 when I was working at Blue Cross and the that it really took off then. I'm wondering, for counties that don't have that now, is there any type of technical support that you'd envision, any kind of way to encourage that? Because I think the integration of the county services, the public health resources, the human services resource is very powerful. So that's one question I have, Representative Fisher.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, Chair and Representative Breyer. Great suggestion. This is part of what I'm looking for as we're having the discussion here, things to incorporate in. I think that's a great, great idea, is providing ways to help support the creation of more of these county programs in a way that is proven working elsewhere.
All right. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My second last question is about Subdivision 3. The provider reimbursement and supplemental payments for care coordination and additional services. To me, when I have thought about this, and I've thought about this kind of change to the health care system many times over the years, even prior to being a legislator, and one of the pieces was the need for people with complex medical situations and life situations that combine with their medical needs. And the thing I love about this section, and I would like to hear more about your thinking on it, is that it puts the people who are giving the care to the patients in the middle of the relationship. This, to me, this subdivision is the piece that centers the provider and patient relationship, which has become less of the focus in our current healthcare system and is the place where we absolutely need to be. So Representative Fisher, if you could talk about how you see that playing out and provide a little more detail about it, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Right. And you know what, we're gonna kinda come to the end. So what I'm gonna do, I just wanna make one statement and then we'll let Representative Fisher close and maybe he can incorporate that into his closing statement, if that's okay. So I'm so glad, Representative Ryer, that you mentioned about this issue about options, which has come up a couple times in this hearing. I think that if we were to poll Minnesotans and say, what does it mean to you to have options? They don't want to choose an insurance company. People hate buying insurance. They hate choosing insurance. Insurance is complicated. It's hard to compare plans. What people want choice of is their doctor, is their healthcare provider, is their facility that they can go to, which hospital are you going to go to, not which insurance company are you going to choose. And what we're doing in our current system is forcing people to, everyone by definition is on a public program, it's the same public program, we're then forcing them to choose an insurance company. And we didn't get into the data on this here, but you know, there are rules about what the choices are and how it gets presented to people and what happens if they don't choose. And it would be interesting to find out how many people just don't choose and then get put into an insurance company. So I think that this idea that people really want to pick their insurer is a myth, I would say. But anyway, to you, Representative Fisher, to close.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Breyer, and committee. This is what it's all about, is what you hit on, is how do we make sure that we've got the right care being provided and making it centered around the individual, the person providing the services. And that's why we've expanded so much in some of these other areas, is looping in for people who are very mobile, for people who are very vulnerable. They don't always have the capacity to help do that, and making sure that we've got those services that are wraparound to make sure that we do a better job going forward. And I will stop there. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm looking forward to the continued discussion.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Fisher. So House File 693, as amended, is laid over. Thank you. All right. We will now go to House File 474, Representative Hewitt. Thank you for your patience, Representative Hewitt. We are a little bit behind. Welcome back to the committee. And so the chair will move that House File 474 be laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Hewitt, please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Bierman, and Lee Schumacher. I appreciate being back home again. I will consider this committee home, and you'll probably see me a few more times. This bill, I'm going to take you to a place that some of you have been. Others are going to go there, but we all will have this discussion. You get called into a family conference. The family conference exists of a nurse, a doctor, maybe a spiritual leader, and a social worker. And you have that hard discussion. And there's not a dry eye in the place when you have this discussion about end-of-life care. And it's really important that the end-of-life care is in the control of the patient. And this is where the patient actually gets an input, or the patient's directives are put in place to say, you know what, if I were to start going down a hole that would, you know, I couldn't sustain life anymore, I either want you to go ahead and resuscitate me, or, you know what, I don't. So bring it to today. As an EMS worker, I have been involved with many of these. I've been involved, unfortunately, with a number of family gatherings where we had to make this decision for loved ones. Mm-hmm. But I've been involved more as an EMT, where you would end up getting called when someone has this order. However, the family panicked a little bit because the order does not say do not make comfortable. It means basically you're not going to do certain things. Mm-hmm. But the family's not comfortable with what's going on. The EMS gets involved. You get there and they say, we have what they call a do not resuscitate, do not intubate order. But if we don't have the order, and we know what every order, every EMT learns this really quick, paramedic, nurse, doctor, knows exactly what that order looks like. If that order is not present, we have to resuscitate. And this is unfortunate for that family that just went through that terrible conference and has made the decision. What this bill does is gives the Department of Health the ability to develop a system that we put an online mechanism or conduit in place so that we can access this information electronically. People lose documents. People don't carry documents with them. This would help us so the medics, EMTs, police officers, first responders, and yes, even doctors and clinics would have the data they need. This is not what I'm hearing about, because I think we have one opposition on this, which is the Catholic Conference, not the church. The conference has written a letter on this to say this is some kind of death registry. That is so untrue. To get to this point, you have to go through many, many levels. The doctors have to agree. You have to agree. Other people like social workers and psychologists have to agree that this is probably the best option. And how would you want it to be your own good? How would you want this? That's what you have to look at, is yourself and your family and your kids making this decision. So I, Madam Chair, I really appreciate that you're going to hold this over. There is going to be a fiscal note because we are developing a committee. And I think that not a committee. We're looking for them to form a task group to put the scaffolding in place to get this going. So back to you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Hewitt. So we do have one testifier, I believe, and that is Dr. Nicholson. Why don't we have Dr. Nicholson come testify, and then we'll go to questions. So welcome to the committee. Please just state your name and go ahead.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, my name is Will Nicholson. I'm a family physician and a hospitalist practicing in the East Metro, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Medical Association. I want to take just a brief second to acknowledge all the amazing work that physicians, frontline healthcare providers, and families do to try to make the best possible outcome for end-of-life care. It's happening today in Minnesota. It often takes heroic effort, and this will help these people deliver better care for their loved ones. I'm here to support House File 474. This bill is needed to ensure that my patients' health care decisions at the end of life are known and followed. PULSED empowers patients. That acronym stands for Provider Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, or PULSED. That's the sort of professional parlance that we use to talk about these orders. These are critical tools that physicians and patients use to document patient preferences for the treatment they want at the end of life. They are medical orders, and they have been widely used in Minnesota by hospitals, long-term care facilities, and medical professionals, plus EMS, for well over 10 years. They're used to indicate the type of care that a patient desires, such as whether to resuscitate or not, whether to intubate or not, whether to go to the hospital at all. Currently, most pulsed orders exist as paper forms. Yes, paper. Patients keep copies of these forms. However, the copies, as noted, can be misplaced, damaged, or become otherwise inaccessible. If an emergency medical personnel or an emergency department does not have access to the pulse form, medical orders may unintentionally go unfollowed, and the patient may receive treatment that they do not want. These end-of-life decisions are agonizing. They're not easy to make. They take great effort and great emotion, but families and health professionals are willing to do this because they want to ensure that their loved one or their patient's wishes are known and followed. You can imagine the frustration if a patient wakes up in a hospital bed after specifically outlining in their pulse with a medical order that they do not want to be transported outside of their home. These gaps can be extremely traumatic for patients, for their families, and even for the healthcare providers when they realize the patient's wishes have not been followed and we've delivered care that they did not want. All of this because a piece of paper is often the best communication tool we have for communicating pulsed across healthcare settings. This is tragic, and it is preventable with simple modern communication tools. So instead of a paper form, we need a statewide database for pulsed. And House File 747 directs Commissioner Health to form an advisory committee of healthcare providers, patients, ethicists, attorneys, EMS, and the religious community to study and recommend how to implement a statewide online registry for pulsed so that they can be accessed by care providers anytime, anywhere, when a patient needs it. As a physician, I want to ensure that every patient's wishes are followed, every single one, every single time. A statewide registry for pulse will help ensure that our patients have their wishes followed at the end of life, every time. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer questions.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Nicholson. So we have three members on the list. I'm really going to ask members to be brief because we do have one other bill, and I don't want to have to send the other testifiers away without testifying. So, Representative Backer.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Hewitt. First of all, just to let people know, the number one location for these forms are on the refrigerator. That is the number one location, as Representative Hewitt, as an EMT. The second thing is I remember when my neighbor, his wife passed away, I was the first one on scene, and I asked him, do you have a non-resuscitate order? And he froze. This is so common when you come on scenes that people just freeze, even though they know about it. But when the event happens, they are just, I've seen it many times over the last 28 years. So I do support this. The only concern that I have is that obviously we don't always get accurate information because we have family members who want you to do everything for mom and dad, and then you have another family member who says, we have this document, and they can't find it. So as an EMS personnel, we are obligated, morally obligated, to provide life-saving care. But that database has to be accurate. So I would really like to continue to work on it. I've been in those extremely difficult situations, extremely. I had a run like that just 5 weeks ago over the weekend, because when I get back, I serve. So thank you for the bill. Want to continue to work with the author on that bill to make sure that that database has the accurate information from the patient and not others. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Packer. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hewitt, for bringing this bill forward. I just had a conversation with a constituent last week who had been to the doctor and received a document to fill out end-of-life things, and one of the things she said was, I don't want resuscitation. Where do you think I should put this document so family members can find it? And I suggested the refrigerator, but having had this conversation previously. But I just want to thank you for doing this. I in fact, told her about this hearing, and I told her that hopefully we'd have a system in place soon, and she's very appreciative. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this working?
No.
No. Is this better?
Not really. I think the ones on the Republican side are working and the DFL not. But maybe we should switch sides. Go ahead, Representative Elkins.
Okay, so I'm just going to talk loud. How's that? I've got my typical wonky technical question. So I've got, I have an advanced care directive, and it has been scanned, and there is a copy of the scanned document associated with my electronic health record in my primary care physician's instance of Epic. So I'm reading this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but way I'm interpreting this is that instead of that, you would create an order record in the electronic health system. So that rather than it being an image of a paper document, it would be literally an order that would be stored in the electronic health record. And the objective here would be to make that order accessible to other providers.
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, kinda. That's why we're getting the stakeholder group together, yep, of physicians, of EMS providers, all of them. This is beyond the record. This is actually a record that would be kept that we can access, yep, through the state database, that if I'm going to a run, I'll be able to pull that up, or at the run, I'd be able to pull it up. I don't have access to your medical records even as an ambulance person. Yep. Doesn't happen. But this is something that we think we should have access to.
All right. Representative Elkins.
Quick follow-up. I think you're probably going to also have to look at the Minnesota Health Records Act. That might be a barrier as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for that. Okay. And Representative Bonner, final statement, question.
Thank you. And I'll try to be brief. I think one of the other pieces that really hasn't been mentioned in this conversation is about bringing this back to being a person-centered approach. I've mentioned many times my mother was a nurse, ER, urgent care, and cardiac critical care. You have folks who are very, very sick, and she has counseled many, many families on what it looks like in those moments where there are critical decisions to be made and making sure wishes are representative. But what we missed here is that we often have these conversations about what it looks like, for example, to be resuscitated, right? If you're elderly, there can be a great deal of bruising, there can be pain, there can be a number of different things that can happen physically, mentally, and emotionally when someone is resuscitated. And so I really applaud the idea of being able to have this, because to your point, in that moment, when the life is on the line, when things are difficult, and we rely on children, no, in a stressful situation, we are placing an undue burden on those individuals to be responsible for the wishes of their loved one. And for that individual, it is paramount that they want their wishes to be represented and to take that burden off of their family. And so I really applaud this effort, and I want to thank you for the bill.
All right, thank you. Closing comment, Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you again. We heard this bill last year. I'm hoping you can support it in your bigger bill. As you heard, it's a very, we need something like this to move forward, and I'm looking forward to working with Representative Backer on where we have to go with this. So thank you, Madam Chair. And
thank you. All right. Thank you very much. So House File 474 is laid over for possible inclusion. So we will move now to House File 732, Representative Herr. And just to give members, we may run over just a few minutes on this hearing to make sure we cover House File 732. And Representative Herr moves House File 732 that it be laid over for possible inclusion, and there is an amendment. Did you want to move the amendment right now, Representative Herr?
That would be great, Madam Chair.
All right. So Representative Herr moves the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which she would like to discuss it. All in favor of the A3, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The A3 is adopted. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to cut out all of my intro because we're going to, this is a really good bill that has bipartisan support, and I have testifiers here that I really think it's important to hear from. Just a really quick brief overview that this bill actually impacts our program called the Housing Support, which is actually a statewide program that helps, it's a housing program that pairs housing assistance with case management, and it actually supports seniors and adults with disabilities and those from low income. And so it is a really great bill, and it does ensure that these individuals who fall into these categories do not pay more than an entire portion of their income and their supplemental income in order to be a part of this program. So with that, I'm going to actually just turn it over to my testifiers, Madam Chair, if that is okay.
All right. Very good. Thank you. And so sorry about the time crunch here. And I know we were going to even maybe do a little educational thing about housing support, but thanks for that little brief one, Representative Herr. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lorna Schmidt. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy with Catholic Charities Twin Cities. We're a regional leader of housing, emergency shelter, and direct services, supporting more than 20,000 youth, adults, and families each year. This bill is all about housing support and improving housing and homelessness outcomes while putting money back in the pockets of our lowest income Minnesotans. We're really excited to work with Representative Herr and partners from across the state to bring this one forward again this year. As Representative Herr said, housing support is about more than rent. It works with supportive housing providers and independent landlords across the state to pair housing assistance with case management services and basic necessities like food, bed and linens, laundry, and cleaning supplies. It is one of the state's best tools to help people exit homelessness. In 2020 to 2021, it actually helped move more than 7,500 individuals into stable housing. But it's important to note that it can also prevent homelessness. So why reform it? Well, right now, people who are enrolled in the program pay a portion of their income each month towards their housing costs, but that's not the problem. The problem is the way that the state treats unearned income when determining how much each individual must pay. Under current policy, the state can take all but $121 from an individual's unearned income every month to pay for housing support costs. Unearned income includes supplemental security income, or SSI, retirement survivors and disability insurance, also known as RSDI, veterans benefits, tribal per capita payments, and even unemployment insurance income and child support. Especially for people who may be receiving SSI, this can add up to as much as 90% of one's income every month, leaving them just $121 to pay for everything that's not covered by the program, like a phone, transportation, clothing, a haircut, and any emergency expenses that might pop up. As a result, there are individuals who are in shelter and on the street who are eligible for housing through housing support, but are turning it down and choosing to stay on the streets instead, because accepting it would mean losing virtually all control of their already limited finances. There are housing support tenants who, as leaseholders, are actually at risk of eviction because they can't afford to pay both their rent and their other monthly expenses. And there are people who want to transition off the program but can't, because $121 isn't enough to save for a security deposit or a first month's rent, much less anything else. This bill would ensure that individuals aren't forced to pay more than 30% of their unearned income, including SSI and veterans benefits, towards their housing support costs. It does not change eligibility for the program. The bill is the product of conversations with individuals with lived experience of homelessness, our staff, shelter and housing providers, veterans and disability nonprofits, counties, and many others. It would help more individuals exit homelessness, it would help those with housing keep it, and it would help those who are working to transition off the program build the savings and skills to do so successfully. We ask for your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. Did you also want to testify, Mr. Engstrom? Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. I am Tim Engstrom. I'm the Communications Director for the American Legion Department of Minnesota. I'm also the Gambling Manager for Bloomington American Legion Post 550. And I mention that because in both roles, I work to prevent veteran homelessness. According to the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, the map of Minnesota looks like this when it comes to veteran homelessness. Every county in the state has achieved functional zero, except for Hennepin and Ramsey counties. Functional zero means the resources are in place to find shelter for homeless veterans as the various nonprofits and government agencies dealing with homelessness discover them. No one is left to remain outside unless they really, really want to. A nationwide goal among the good folks working with the overall unsheltered and homeless population is this. If we can tackle veteran homelessness first, then it provides a model for us to tackle all homelessness, to achieve functional zero for all homelessness. So the veterans who experience homelessness, they often struggle with barriers, as you know, drugs, alcohol, and other things. But it's not always those things. You know, you can't always picture everybody being the same. And for some of them, they have legal troubles or financial problems. And a ray of hope that they have is they still have their disability check. And some, it's even their career pension check. The state calls these VA benefits unearned income. But ask any veteran across the United States, and they will tell you that their benefits are very much earned. How many people in this room would lose an arm for their country? And if you did, would you like the state to take away your disability check? Well, the state requires they turn over their money except for $120, $121 a month when they enter the services of a homeless shelter. You know, my fellow Minnesotans, these homeless veterans are making the same kitchen table decisions you and I make. Do I remain homeless and keep my money, or do I go into a shelter and lose it? This is a barrier our state puts in their way at a time that we have a large state surplus, no less. Removing it would go a long way toward helping Hennepin and Ramsey counties achieve the governor's goal of statewide functional zero. How many of you could get back on your feet if the state took 90% of your income? None of us could. How do we expect them to bounce back then? Please, let's do the right thing and pass this bill. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much. So is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify on the bill? Not seeing anybody. Okay, so any member discussion? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr. I think this is a great bill. I think this is an important thing that we can do. It's a move in the right direction to try to ensure that we can provide more housing for a lot of those populations that struggle. I would love it, however, if we could, you know, we have a lot of these initiatives both at the county level and at the state level. I would love it if we could put a report in here, because we're basically taking, we're increasing the amount of money that's being left in people's pockets, which is fantastic. It would be great if we could see a report on how that directly contributed to people staying in supportive housing. I would love to see that, and I think it would be super important as we move forward and identify those interventions that we put in place that are trying to move people into more stable housing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Representative Akam, did I see your hand? No? Okay. Any other member discussion? All right. Final word, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and committee, for hearing this bill. In your package, just so you know, you have a lot of support from partners, but also organizations representing just a wide variety of individuals with people with lived experiences, but also just across different advocacy groups. And we have about 50 partners in this work. Representative Doe, I look forward to having conversation with you about how we can. There is some reporting already, but we can always do more to understand, you know, the impact. So I'd love to work with you off, you know, outside of committee. And this is a good bill, and it is being laid over, so we definitely have time to have a discussion. And we are still waiting our fiscal note, Chair, so hopefully we get a chance to revisit this and get it out of committee. But thank you so much for the support.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hurst. So with that, House file 732, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. So, members, we have reached the end of our time. Obviously, we have one more bill we were going to hear. We keep kicking it over. It's mine, just to show I don't get priority here. But just please leave it in your packet so that we don't have to reprint the documents, if you would. So with that, thank you very much for everybody who presented and to all of our testifiers. We are adjourned.